Morning. And good morning. So today I'm going to talk first about a sentence from Shakespeare and then move into sort of a Zen sentence that doesn't exactly parallel it, but has some similarities and some differences. Can you hear me? Okay. So, to be or not to be, that is the question. Hamlet, right? To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them. This is Hamlet's predicament. And most of Shakespeare's tragic heroes have a similar predicament. So Shakespeare is dealing with a lot in his tragedies, and in his comedies too, but best in his tragedies with suffering, and the suffering that we as human beings all experience. And the suffering that comes and goes sometimes seems to pervade our lives. Sometimes we seem to be free of it for a little bit, and then it comes back. And so there are two ways in which this Shakespearean phrase is generally interpreted, although I'm sure there are many other ways, but two ways. The first is the literal one, that when he says to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them, he's talking about just that, about literally the choice to end life, the choice to end one's own life, which is not that familiar to most of us. Most of us have known someone who at some point has wanted to end their lives. And many of us ourselves, at some point in our lives, we thought, oh, enough. I want to be out of here, whether we have clinical depression or not. This has been endemic, I think, in modern America. Maybe in ancient America, too. I don't know. I didn't live in ancient America. But in modern America, endemic. And, of course, that's a motive to do some spiritual practice, possibly a motive. And the other meaning, the other most common interpretation of this is that when he's saying whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them, he's talking about the first one, living passively, just enduring this suffering, just saying I can't do anything about it, just saying everything's impossible, I'll just do what I can with drugs and alcohol and sex or whatever, you know, I'll just get along, versus being proactive, taking arms against the sea of troubles, being proactive. And of course, in Hamlet, he does neither. He does neither. So that's why scholars can go with either interpretation. And often we're just as bad as he is, or just as good as he is. He's not bad. He's just paralyzed by his suffering. And we've all experienced that. So this is a Shakespearean play, and we have our own Shakespeare, Eugene O'Neill, one of our own Shakespeare, and many others. Eugene O'Neill just comes to my mind. But for the most part, Americans, we're optimists. So for the most part, we are good at taking arms against the sea of troubles. That's our forte, that we're known for being able to pull ourselves together and do something, take on a challenge, think positively. When I go to visit my daughter who lives in France, and has lived there for too many years and probably is not going to live any. Oh, okay. It went out. Is it out? Oh. Is it working?
No.
No. Okay. We'll have a little technical adjustment here, maybe.
I hear it. I'm going to turn the volume up.
Can you hear me now? A moment of zazen. How's that? Maybe you guys will have to move in here.
Actually, the speaker there works. The speaker there apparently is going out.
I see. I see. Well, can you hear me now? All right. Okay. So much for the Sea of Troubles. Pretty simple, huh? See, we're Americans. We figure out how to do it. We figure out how to change it. So when I go to France and see my daughter, people say, oh, you Americans, you always think you can improve the world. You always think you can change things. And some of them love us for that, and some of them hate us for that. And really, they have a love-hate relationship with us. They hate George W. Bush. The audacity, they think, that he thought he could move into Iraq, transform it into his democracy, kill some guy, and then all of a sudden the people would, they hate that. They love Martin Luther King. That Martin Luther King, even though he knew the odds were totally against him, based on history, based on post-Civil War history, totally against him, that he thought he could make a difference, that he thought he could help our country pay attention to the needs of black people. And look, what would Martin Luther King think today if he saw Barack Obama about to get nominated for president? The French are amazed at us, but also very annoyed with us. So that's our trait. Those are our two sides, right? Our two sides. So when I started practice, and this may be true for some of you who have practiced for a while or just starting practice, I was suffering the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. At least I thought I was. I mean, it was all inside. It's usually mostly inside. I was almost flunking out of college. I didn't have any friends. I hated my life. All I liked to do was drink, but it made me sick, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Long story made short, right? So I happened to just read a book on Zen, happened to think, oh, well, maybe I can turn my life around by doing this, especially if I can find a Zen teacher, if there happens to be one anywhere. And I found one in San Francisco, little old guy. So I began to take arms against my sea of troubles with Zen meditation and hanging out with him. I dropped out of college and worked on it for a long time. And after I had been working with him for 3 years, then I went to a monastery. And lived there for a while. And as I was taking arms against my outrageous fortunes, which they're embarrassingly not outrageous on the outside, embarrassingly. I don't want to tell you what the outside was because it's embarrassing to me. But on the inside, they were awful. They were awful. That's another thing the French can't understand. They say, you have all this depression, and look at all you have. Look at all you have. We're just wanting to get a job. But that's our situation, isn't it? It's our situation. So, last talk I gave, I talked about different approaches to Zazen, or different facets of Zazen, of Zen meditation. Bringing the physical dharmas into view, our immediate sense experience, bringing that into view, our body, our breathing, coming back to that. That's the first type of way in which we do our Zen meditation. The second one is cultivating wholesome dharmas. So I had to, and that means wholesome thoughts, thoughts that I can do this, thoughts that I want to do this, that I want to help people, I want to stay calm, wholesome, healthy. So any time you make a commitment to do this kind of practice, you need to have some help in terms of your internal dialogue, some helpful things. So I used helpful things my first few years. I probably still do, but I don't pay too much attention to it anymore. I used helpful things. My teacher would say something to me, and every time I'd be upset, I'd say it over to myself. I'd write it down. I'd take it home. I'd pin it on the refrigerator. I'd do something dumb like pin it to my, I'm not dumb, but pin it to the little center of your steering wheel. That reminds me of guru stuff, so you should be careful. But anyway, it helps. It helped. If it helps, who cares? People can call it guru stuff. But then when I was at the monastery, we say monastery, but it was men and women. It still is men and women. In California, Tassajara Monastery. It was really hard for me. The summer there, it was so hot. Because I have never lived in the Midwest then. Maybe if I had spent a few summers in the Midwest, that would have been okay. But I had never experienced heat like that. 100, 105 during the day, dry heat. And we all were supposed to wear long sleeves, so perspiration all over my body, and then I had to do these nested eating bowls, because for my first few years we just ate with knives and forks, but all of a sudden we had to do these oreokis, these nested eating bowls, and I was had an awful time and the perspiration that went into the well, we won't get into the details. Very hard, and doing manual labor in the day and getting a pain in my back, and then having to go sit straight when I just wanted to lie down in the meditation hall after a pain in my back. So all my wholesome dharmas turned into unwholesome dharmas, right? All my positive dharmas, even if turned into, and then I want to just get out of there, which is kind of happens often in a Zen monastery. Pretty often it happens. You just want to get out of there. And then, I've talked about this before, Suzuki, my teacher, Suzuki Roshi, gave me something to repeat from the Heart Sutra, Gyate, Gyate, which then became my new wholesome dharma. Those others weren't working, so my new one. So every time I would have a pain in my back, I would say, Gyate, Gyate. Every time I would feel like I couldn't get up after sitting because my back was so sore, I would just say, Gyate, Gyate, and not try to get up, just let myself take a little time to get up. Every time that I would think about getting out of there, it was hard to get out of there because there was no bus. And you couldn't hitchhike because there was just a dirt road this is the bottom of a deep valley, a Carmel Valley. And you could walk out, but it would take you, gee, I don't know. No, I never. It'd probably take you 3 hours, and then when you got to the top, you'd have to find somebody to give you a ride, and there was no road close by. Anyway, it would be embarrassing to leave. Besides, my wife was there. And my wife, who had no particular interest in Zen, not, well, she did, she had an interest in Zen, but not in the way I did. I have deep interest, you know, my life. She was just going blissfully along, doing the Orioki, teaching it to people, not perspiring. Of course, she didn't have to work, you know, hitting the rocks, doing the rocks, but just, which that really gave me a lot of unwholesome dharmas. They were coming up all the time, so I had especially gate for that. Luckily, she quit, so I didn't have to compete with her anymore. So, I made it through that monastic experience, those two monastic experiences in the summer and in the winter. In the winter, we had no heat. Of course, this was not Minnesota, this is California. And it got down to maybe 33 at night, and the really cold nights. But we had no heat, and we only had screens on our windows, so it was cold. So anyway, I think that's maybe enough on Shakespeare's interpretation. Now I'll go to Zen, what Zen has to say about being. To be is not to be. That's what Zen says. To be is not to be. To be is not to be. That's what we say. Not to be or not to be. To be is not to be. And you need to look into that if you're a Zen student. You need to look at that. What is that? We say emptiness is form. Form is emptiness. Not to be is to be. To be is not to be. So the story of the older Zen practitioner and his younger brother, and they're going to see the deceased teacher's grave. And the younger one knocks on the grave, and he says, "Is he alive or is he dead?" And what's the older one say? "I will not say. I will not say. To live is to die. To die is to live." What is that? Are we crazy, us Zen teachers? Or is there something there? Whatever your polarity is, whatever it is, the other side. To live is to die is to live. Emptiness is form, form is emptiness. To be is not to be. For us, that's the deep question. That's the very deep question. And that's an example of fourth type of practice in Zen. The first being bringing the physical dharmas into view. The second being bringing the positive mental dharmas into view. The third being, I'm not talking about it today, bare attention or shikantaza. And the fourth, deep questioning out of your doubt, out of your concern about life-death, about being non-being, about even to be or not to be, although you need to go beyond that either-or stuff. And you will, if you sit. You will. So, in Soto Zen, we don't ask ourselves when we sit the answers to koans, like, what is the sound of one hand clapping? Instead, we have some kind of natural koan, some kind of natural problem that comes up. And based on some polarity in our mind, between life and death, between being and non-being, between emptiness and form, between the ideal self and the real self, whatever it is. And that becomes the focus. That's a wonderful focus. And Dogen's question, and those of you who studied Dogen with me know that what his personal question was, why do I have to sit if everything has the Buddha nature? He started that early, and then it turned, we think, into like, what is this? What is the Buddha nature? And then just what? Intensifying, focusing. not getting caught by the dualities. And whenever you do, coming back to this question, whatever it is, of being, not being. So the Chinese Zen master was asked by his student, what is the meaning of form is emptiness? Or we could say, what is the meaning of to be is not to be? And the teacher said, asking the question is enough. Make your bows and retire. Make your bows and retire. I can give you an answer to emptiness is form. The form is emptiness. I've been teaching Zen here now for almost, five, 6 years. I can give you an answer. And those of you who are in study group with me, you have lots of answers. You are getting smarter all the time. I don't mean to be judging. Actually, those answers help. Those are bringing positive mental dharmas, positive mental constructs into view that will encourage you. But sometimes it's better to let go of those. If you want to go deep, that answer that I give you is not the answer. It may make you feel good for a while. Or maybe may not make you feel good. But I want it to make you feel good. Because I get attached to helping you. So, asking the question is enough. Make your bows and retire. Retire from trying to figure it out. And move your energy from trying to figure it out to trying to be someone in particular, from trying to be in control, from trying to be loved and liked. Move your energy from that to just being, to just looking into this being, non-being. Just looking at it. Just looking at it. And we say in Zen that that deep questioning can really only come to fruition if first you've done one or both of the first two practices. That is, if you've done some bringing physical dharmas into view, which means watching your breathing in your meditation, doing whatever you your posture, doing whatever you can to slow down the diarrhea of your thinking, or bringing the mental dharmas into view, mentally to slow down your negative thinking, to convert it. Only when you've worked on those first two pretty well can you really move into shikantaza, bare attention, or deep questioning. Because questioning without that will just be questioning which is all over the place. It's not deep. Doesn't penetrate. Just gets caught by all your ruminations, by all your worrying, by all your comparing. So that's why David was saying to me the other day that, what's the name of that guy? Do the 3 days? David, yeah, Goenka. David was saying that when he didn't... 4 days. When he did with meditation with Goenka
he's in Shelburne Falls.
In Shelburne Falls. They did like an 8-day retreat or something?
10-day
retreat. The first 4 days, they just focus on what we call bringing the physical dharmas into view. And then when they've got a stable enough focus, then they can move on. But that's a little bit, we don't do it that way because to us that seems a little artificial. That is to say, so many days on this. It's just you and your own process. So just do what helps. Just do what helps. And if you do that, if you do this questioning, you'll generate heat. We were talking about this in a study group the other day. You'll generate heat. The heat is from your angst, and of course you can do all kinds of activities with your angst. But instead of doing activities, instead of doing wish-fulfilling things and self-injurious sorts of thoughts, This angst, we bring this into focus, and this becomes helps our questioning. We get heat from our zazen, actually. The heat comes up, called tapas in Sanskrit. The tapas comes up from our zazen. But don't try to cultivate it. In Rinzai, they try to cultivate it, and then they're always making extra problems for themselves. It just comes up. For Dogen, it just came up from, he kept asking himself this question about, what's this Buddha nature stuff anyway? Here I've just got pain in my legs, and even they gave me transmission even. They told me I was a teacher, but I'm still suffering. I'm still confused. What is this? What is this? It generates heat. And that cooks the ego. We don't want to destroy ego. We just want to cook it a little bit. If you destroy ego, that's not good. But just cook it so it becomes nice and soft. Nice and soft. People who, and to do this practice with seriousness, there's daily sitting, but as I say over and over again, we also do have a lot of retreat days. We have more than 20 retreat days a year at Zen Center, and people who are practicing with me, working with me to become teachers, I expect them to do at least 12 retreat days a year. That's because retreat means retiring in the way that this teacher was using it. Retiring. You have to retire from your normal everyday worries and concerns, from your normal everyday rushing around to do this practice. And in 3 weeks, we're going to have another retreat down at the beautiful Hokkyoji land. Be a nice time of year. And that will be a contemporary retreat. And some of our retreats are contemporary and some traditional. There are a couple of reasons that I like contemporary retreats in addition to the more liturgical retreats. The contemporary retreats don't have any liturgy. Liturgy is wonderful and beautiful and I love it. But one problem with liturgy is that everybody is comparing how they're doing it to the next person. And if you're doing that, you're not really doing zazen. You can't do that and do zazen. It's just monkey mind activity. Oh, she's doing it better. Oh, he's doing it better. Oh, I should do it like this. Oh, what's the next move? Which move is best and worst? You can't focus on the central question of life-death if you're doing that stuff, if you're getting caught by that stuff. Yeah, once you get it down, you can do it. But as long as you're comparing, you can't. You can't. So, the other day, I was reminded by something I read of... by Steve Stuckey, who's the abbot of San Francisco Zen Center, of an experience I had, which actually I have never talked about. I'm saying that because I've given so many talks, and to find experiences that I've never talked about gets harder and harder. So there's a Zen story about a Chinese administrator who was a top dog administrator, or a top dog. He had a big purview in his administrative district. He went to see Bird's Nest Roshi. Well, Bird's Nest Roshi is called Bird's Nest Roshi because he does zazen in a tree. He does zazen sitting in a tree. An administrator went to see Bird's Nest Roshi, and he looked up in the tree, and Bird's Nest Roshi was way up there. And he said to Bird's Nest Roshi, "You must be feeling insecure up there." And Bird's Nest Roshi waved to him. I don't know if he waved, but I'll wave. He waved to him, and he said, "You must be feeling insecure down there." And the Chinese administrator was feeling insecure. That's why he'd come to see Bird's Nest Roshi. And he was insecure because he was trying to govern his land, trying to govern a land is not easy. And first he would try to be in control of everyone, and then everyone would piss and moan. Then he would try to be nice to people, and then things would get out of control. Then he would go to try to be more controlling, and people wouldn't like him. Back and forth, back and forth. So he took Burden S. Roshi on as his teacher. We don't know if Burden S. Roshi got him to come up in the tree to sit or what, but that's the story. And that reminded me from this talk that Steve Stuckey gave, reminded me of being in Africa about 14 years ago. I was in Africa. My daughter was in the Peace Corps there, and I went to Africa to be with her, my wife and I. And we went to Zimbabwe. You could travel in Zimbabwe then. And we were at the border of Zimbabwe and whatever those other countries are that border Zimbabwe. I'm not remembering right now. We were at Victoria Falls, huge, beautiful falls. And we found out that there were guides that would take you on rafts over the rapids below the falls down the Zambezi River. And Aaron and I were into that, boy. Into that. And Linda said, "You've got to be crazy. I'm not doing that." My wife, "I'm not doing that." So we got a guide, and we went on one of these rafts. And I don't remember. This is a long time ago. I don't know where they put helmets on our heads, but they should have. Probably they didn't. Probably they didn't. And they strapped us into these rafts, you know, like a seat belt kind of thing. And we went tooling off down the Zambezi River below the falls, where my wife was above the falls taking a nice little canoe ride on the Zambezi. Well, it was great, you know, lots of rapids. Well, and then what happened? Well, the boat raft turned over, it capsized. And I don't know, there were maybe 8 of us in it plus our guide, and we capsized. And we were upside down in the Zambezi River for, I don't know how long, 10 seconds, 20 seconds, 30 seconds. And we were seat belted in. So we were pretty secure upside down going through the rapids in the Zambezi River. Imagine that. And I don't really know how long it lasted for. But then, all of a sudden, we righted again. And we were in some still pool right below the Zambezi. And our driver, our raft driver or whatever, he got us to the shore. And everybody was just totally wiped out. And these two people in front of me who looked old to me, they looked like about 65, really old. They just were white as a sheet. And my daughter was crying. She said, "Dad, I thought we were going to die. And I haven't even finished my Peace Corps experience." And so that was, at that same time, there was a kind of a heavy guy who was he seemed like an American in front of us, wearing one of these flowered American-like shirts that Americans like to wear. And, you know, the Americans always show up. I mean, you can tell who they are when you go to foreign countries because the way they dress. He was wearing one of these really flowery shirts. But he was really still. And he acted like he had just come out of a warm bath, out of a tub in his own home. And he was getting water for people who were in a state of collapse. He had some little dried fruit he was passing it around. He was whispering sweet nothings in other people's ears. And he was just wonderful. He calmed everybody down. Meanwhile, the driver, the African driver, was you know, just really in a frenzy himself as to what to do next, because we were kind of caught there on the edge. So anyway, they got us out, and we went back to our hotel. And I said to Aaron, probably on the way back that night, I said, "Oh, I said, did you see that guy? And how calming his presence was? And she said, yeah. She said, is that Zen, Dad? And I said, well, it reminds me of Bird's Nest Roshi. She said, oh, who's Bird's Nest Roshi? Well, then I told her the story. And actually, it's a much longer story about Bird's Nest Roshi. So, this deep questioning, is so we can compose ourselves. So we can compose ourselves, because we're never composed when we're caught by life or death, when we're caught by ideal self or real self, when we're caught by yesterday or tomorrow. We're not composed. We don't live in a composed way. But if you go into this question, if you really go into it, you too will be an incarnation of Bird's Nest Roshi, even though I don't believe in reincarnation. But you might. You might. So. And of course, Bird's Nest Roshi lived 9th, 10th, 11th century. And Zen started in 6th century. But we've been studying Taoism in our evening study group lately. And Taoism, they talk about being, non-being, before Buddha. 200 years before Buddha, Lao Tzu is talking about being, non-being. At the time of Buddha, Chuang Tzu in China is talking about what? Wu Wei, doing, non-doing. Doing, non-doing is a manifestation of being, non-being. That's what this American in the flowery shirt seemed to be doing. He was just doing, but he wasn't doing anything. But people felt better. People felt pretty still. They felt like they were going to be okay. Of course, everybody was fine. You know, we'd only been underwater for at most 30 seconds. So everybody was fine. Nobody was dumb. So the Taoists are our teachers. Bird's Nest Roshi is our teacher. Katagiri Roshi, Suzuki Roshi are our teachers. They're all teaching us that if we do this practice, we too can be helpful to ourselves and others. But by doing non-doing, not by doing it one moment and then non-doing the other moment. Oh, I'm going to do Zazen. I'll be still in Zazen. That's non-doing. Then I'm going to rush off and go to the cleaners and do this. And I'm going to come back and do Zazen. Calm for a while, and I rush off. That's not doing non-doing. But you can discover it if you go into it, if you go all the way into it, and it will generate a lot of heat. I know that. But you have heat anyway from your angst. So why not focus it a little bit? Why not focus it? Bring it back here and go into it. We've been doing it since Chuang Tzu, probably since Lao Tzu, probably since 1,000 years before. We just don't have any written records, so we don't know. So, come join us at Hokyoji for 2 days or 5 days or 7 days. And if not, then do another retreat. We'll have one in July, we'll have one in August, we'll have one in September. Okay. Questions? Comments? No, I don't know where they all are. They're all here except the Hokyoji one, which is in June. And there's something in September down there too. Most of them are here. Other than the one in June and the one in September, they're all right here in this building. So you don't have to go far. Questions? Comments? Yeah?
Isn't that like suffering and non-suffering? Isn't it like mostly the same thing?
Suffering and non-suffering?
I mean, kind of like that yin-yang, so to speak, in Tao. I mean, although the Tao is more than just putting it to a word, I mean, it's beyond what, you know, the Tao would say is the Tao. You can't really define it.
Uh-huh.
But isn't it part of the same thing?
Well, what's your experience? What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I'm questioning right now.
Well, of course, suffering and non-suffering also. Not two. But we experience them as two, as human beings. Mm-hmm. We're experiencing them as two. And we want to get away from suffering.
Right.
And we want to go to non-suffering. So that's the human situation for all of us. But they're really not two. And if you look at it, if you go into it, you can see that they're not two. But you don't actually see that they're not two. There is seeing that's not your seeing. That's not your seeing. Because it's not possessed by anything. We want to possess. We want to see. We want to know what suffering is. Or non-suffering. We want to know what that is. So that's the situation that we want to get away from suffering. And that brings us to the cushion, which is good. But then really... we experience more suffering when we're on the cushion, although we also experience more peace, and then we get really confused. But there's no difference. Just go into it. And if your mind gets too activated, then you need to come back to the first two practices, which are your physical dharmas, your physical experiential moments, coming back to those. Even if you're not sitting in zazen, if you're out raking, you know, how does that raking feel? Where are your hands on that rake? What's the back and forth motion like? Coming back to... Or the positive mental dharma, saying to yourself, raking, raking, raking. And maybe singing, raking, raking, raking. That's a positive dharma, a wholesome dharma. Singing while you rake. So that you can be there. And then you can go into the question. But if you're not here, you can't go into the question because the question just is all over the place.
Right?
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Other people?
Pardon? You know what? I asked a question. I don't even know the question.
Repeat the question. Oh, did this cut out again? I can't hear. The original question was about suffering and non-suffering. Oh, I see. Yeah, you couldn't hear the question because he doesn't have the mic.
No, even before that, the question is a riddle.
All right. Yeah?
The questioning, did you formulate it into words?
You mean in my talk?
Yeah.
Well, you can formulate this question to any word you want, but the question comes out of you as you get really serious about your life and about life-death, about being non-being, about hating-loving. When you get really serious, it takes a form. I don't know what form it will take. For Dogen, it took... Buddha nature? What's that? Buddha nature? What's that? All these teachers are saying it. What is it? What is it? What is it? For each of us, it takes a different form. For each of us. Yeah, all roll into one. And as it becomes more focused and more limited, it generates more heat. That is, first of all, it may be as it was with Dogen when he was 9 or 10. Well, they say everything has the Buddha nature. And that if you sit in zazen, you will realize the Buddha nature. And that seems kind of stupid, but maybe there's something to it. These guys look kind of calm. And maybe I should try this. But I don't know if this Buddha nature... But as he got older, and he got more experience in zazen, the question became more focused until he didn't even know what it was. It was just, life, death. We don't know. Pain, pleasure, we don't know. And at that, when he did that, it's through that, through asking the question, it totally, that he experienced the dropping away of the separation of mind and body. Mind, we think, is separate from body. And we think that way, that's fine. Yeah?
I was wondering, The four, I don't remember what you called them, but the physical dharmas, the mental dharmas, shikantaza, and the deep questioning. So, and that's kind of a process. You start with doing the physical.
But don't be too attached to it. It's kind of a process,
Well, I guess my question is, if shikantaza is
just to sit.
So
shikan means just to, taza means sit. So we say shikan sit, shikan rake, shikan cook, shikan study, just to. Right.
And so, well, the mental dharmas, because I'm not really familiar with the mental dharmas, and I don't ever try to do that. Is that something that throws you off, or is it something that...
No, the mental dharmas are words of encouragement. Words of encouragement. The precepts are words of encouragement. The paramitas, being words about being generous, giving, words of encouragement about giving, words of encouragement about being patient, words of encouragement about being ethical, that you give yourself and then you give to everybody. Words of encouragement about living a meditative, calm life. Words of encouragement about trying to live wisely. Words of encouragement. And they're formalized as gatas in Japanese Zen. Those are little things you repeat to yourself. Like if you go downstairs, you go into the bathroom, you see somebody's put Robert Aiken, he wrote those gatas himself, I think, in the bathroom. Something about, now as I wash my face, what does it go? I don't know. Very nice. It helps you. Just be still as you wash your face. And then the more formal kinds of most formalized wholesome dharmas are mantras. You repeat something to yourself that over and over again that comes from one of the texts. But those are all just ways of, so those are all called bringing the positive mental dharmas into view.
I guess the thing that's new to me is that I was not aware that Zen had that. I thought, like, shikantaza was something that...
Oh, yeah.
Like, that... I feel like it's a fine thing, because if your mind is filled with stuff anyway, you might as well fill it with that sort of stuff.
Uh-huh.
But if you're going to just sit to not get caught on having mantras...
Yeah. Well, you know, that's right. And we do represent... we do say shikantaza, shikantaza, just to sit, just to sit, just to shit. Just to sit. Well, you do that too, don't you? You know, that's what comes when you generate heat, right? You don't know what's going to happen when heat is generated. Some foul stuff is going to come out sometimes. And you just come back. Clean up your mess and come back. We say that, but there is this whole context of Buddhism that Dogen came out of, where there are lots of repetitions of things that will help you. Throughout the day, in Dogen's land, in Dogen's time, they would be repeating things over and over to themselves to help them, to help turning their negative self-talk into bringing themselves back to being present in the moment. And so, you're right, but there's this huge context that this comes out of.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
So is it a pretty regular thing in Soto Zen? Or is it...
Well, yeah, but they don't label it. The early Buddhists labeled it bringing the positive mental dharmas into view. Soto Zen doesn't say that, but they're doing it all the time. I've just been connecting what went on in early Buddhism with what goes on in Soto Zen, and they're not different. They're just talked of. They're described in a different way.
Yeah.
That make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Pardon?
Question about liturgy.
Yeah.
I have to ask it because you might end up doing a lot of liturgy. But you mentioned that actually you don't like it.
No, I like it. I love liturgy. There can be competitiveness. There may be competitiveness. If I didn't love liturgy, we wouldn't have Rahatsu Sesshin the way we have it.
But my question is that's really kind of shallow.
People are shallow.
Well,
Yeah.
You know, the way you bite,
yeah.
The way you sit.
Right.
And so the competitiveness is not inherent in that.
It's not inherent. This is just human beings. Right. We're dealing with human beings as they are. We're not dealing with the ideal human guy. We're dealing with a real human. Real humans compare themselves to each other, especially when they're trying to get something right and when they think there's one right way of doing things. And that comparison creates a lot of thought weights, a lot of angst. And that angst is fine if you focus it, but if you just keep comparing. So having something simplifies without that almost seduction of comparison is good. But also liturgical practice is very good too, because it generates the heat of competitiveness. And if you can turn that into non-competitiveness by going into what is that? What is that? What is that? That's great. But if you're too distracted by trying to get it right or pay attention to what someone else is doing, you won't really be focused. So both. That's why I do both.
You know, I was thinking, as a practice, you know, it's a way to deepen your understanding, right?
Well,
so therefore, we wouldn't want to necessarily just exclude liturgy, right?
No, I'm not excluding liturgy. We do liturgy sometimes. We do lots of liturgy. I love liturgy. I'm just saying that sometimes we need to strip things down and not have anything to compare to and just work on being non-being. And then, of course, you'll still figure something out to compare it to because you are, because you're a human being. But yeah. Oh, I don't have any particular view. Reincarnation, I don't know. I'm like Suzuki Roshi. This is my cop-out for reincarnation. Suzuki Roshi was asked by his students something about reincarnation. He said, well, I don't know about reincarnation. He said, some of the teachers I most admire believe in it. That's about all I can say. I think too much time is spent on it. Too much time is spent thinking about it, whether it exists and what its ramifications are. And that's another, that's a worse distraction than liturgy, is thinking about reincarnation from this question of what is this and who are you and how can you just be here in composure without liturgy or no liturgy, without reincarnation or no reincarnation. But letting them come in, but not getting tossed away by either of them. So that you and I and the Zambezi River can have a good time. Yeah.
I have a comment about reincarnation.
Okay.
You said it's distracting to think, who am I?
Right.
Till you figure out that something is not right, till you realize your Buddha nature.
So you realize what?
Your Buddha nature.
Uh huh. Uh huh.
So I don't think it's distracting. I think it's a big deal.
Okay. Well.
It sounds like you're talking about transmigrating your six realms, and so you.
Okay. All right. Anything else? Yeah.
I was just going to say, it seems that a lot of religion focus in on what happens to them after they die.
Right.
Where it seems that we focus in on the here and now.
That's right.
Trying to pay attention to what we're doing at this moment.
Right.
And if we truly do that, the thought of reincarnation shouldn't really even be in a thought.
That's good. Yes, that's good. That's good. So I've told the story before about Buddha being asked about reincarnation, about being asked about the existence of God and reincarnation and past lives and future lives. And Buddha said, I am just like a warrior who has been wounded by a poison arrow. Is my focus on where the poison arrow came from? What kind of poison was used? What will be the results of this poison on my system? How will my form change as I die? Or getting the arrow out? And the point was, just your point, getting the arrow out. Being, non-being. Form is emptiness. Life is death. Getting it out. Was there something else?
I just appreciated your talk very much. And what it brought to mind for me, and again, I'm kind of paraphrasing this, okay, but I'll simplify it. The four points being, however you worded it, but in my words, I would say physically grounding the body, mentally grounding the mind, which then allows you to focus attention and then allows you to ask these deep questions. And I like that because it makes me think about cognitive behavioral therapy in the sense of you can waste a lot of time in therapy talking about all sorts of stuff, but ultimately if you come down to the behavior, what are you going to do? Make yourself get out of bed and go do something you may not really want to do, but the action is grounding in the physical reality, and then in turn your mind and so forth follows suit. So anyway, I just appreciated that, and also working with people that have been traumatized, I recognize the importance of the need to calm the physical body down, then the mind, which allows the person to then be with that memory of trauma. If you don't have those foundations and have tried to approach it verbally or from an intellectual level, you're not going to get anywhere. You've got to start from that very basic foundation. So I just appreciated what you said.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.